They let you sleep in peace at night and only made the rounds in the mornings, rattling their sticks between 9 and 10 a.m. But the first plane hit at 8:48 a.m. This worries those who have not seen their friends. They cringe at the thought of them sleeping somewhere in the tunnels when the towers fell. And more than 1,500 feet of the 1 and 9 tunnels caved in, and ceilings and steel tumbled to the ground, and the path tunnels became so severely damaged, the station there won't reopen for at least 2 years. 60% of the concourse collapsed or became unstable that day. A third of that area is covered in a solid blanket of debris. A laconic representative for New York City Transit says no riders or workers were hurt or killed in the subway tunnels on September 11th. Captain Anthony Whitaker, the Port Authority officer who led the evacuation, said through his spokesman that he is confident his team completely cleared the concourse that morning. "We're not saying there weren't any people there," says spokesman Don Bladozzi. "We're not aware of anybody, and we don't want to speculate." Timothy Augustus began to frequent the Trade Center about 7 years ago, soon after he arrived here from Illinois. He planned to head downtown afterward. He narrowly avoided getting caught up in the tragedy because, for a change, he started that day at the Port Authority. He planned to head downtown afterward. "I didn't know it had blown down till they evacuated the bus terminal," he said. "They said two planes hit the World Trade Center. I said, oh, man." Since then, he has rapped on doors at the shelters and combed the park near City Hall to no avail. "There are 20 to 25 people I haven't seen since," says Augustus, 38. "Every day I go around asking about all my friends." Social workers from Project Renewal, the service agency that had an outreach office on the World Trade Center concourse, don't think the number of those lost could be nearly that high. "I don't think we had 50 to 100 clients there in a three-week period, much less in an hour and a half," says Scott Williams, who is director of outreach for their World Trade Center office. Three Project Renewal staffers started working at the Trade Center that day at 7 a.m. They escaped after the first plane hit. Team leader Walter Brown says the number of homeless people on the concourse had been down that week because nicer weather drew people outside. After the attack, Project Renewal scoured the street for the people they saw regularly. Slowly, they started to turn up. Ruth was walking down Houston Street. Rich found his way to the John Huss house, his regular cantankerous self. Eventually, they saw them all, except for Mr. Mann and Carlos. Mr. Mann doesn't worry them so much. They think he had an apartment somewhere. He visited the Trade Center more sporadically than the others. Carlos, the man with the dreadlocks who always wore the same sheepskin coat, worries them more, although he'd never talked to them without a fight. He had taken to hanging out on the train stations around the time of the attack, particularly the number two. Still, Williams has the sense that he's all right. "I'm almost positive he got out of there," he said, sounding like the families who conjured hope in the days immediately following the tragedy. Carlos is too ornery to allow that to stop him. Homeless men who knew him, though, have not seen him since September 11th. "Being homeless, you usually see people a lot," Wiley said. "You just don't see those people anymore. There was this one old lady who sat by the bathroom, and she sat there all day long, so much so that the Port Authority cops never bothered her. I always spoke to her, but she was very quiet, a lady who never spoke much. I'd always give her food, money, stuff like that. I just haven't seen her since." The UHO, United Homeless Organization, is planning to collect information about the missing on their website at www.unitedhomelessorganization.com. Meanwhile, the situation deteriorates for the living. Immediately after the attacks, a new crowd of homeless people seem to take to the streets. One idea has it that the rigid new security measures sealed off the nooks where they slept and sent them footing in around town. The attacks also shocked the dreaming city conscious of an already disturbing trend. As the economy sputtered in the months before the attacks, the number of homeless New Yorkers using the shelter system hit 29,000, an all-time high, and an increase of 8,000 over 1998. The numbers regularly receiving food assistance reached 1.6 million a month, more than twice those of 4 years ago. Many advocates attribute this in part to the Giuliani administration's obsession with pushing people off the welfare rolls and into the insecure, low-wage, or informal jobs that evaporate first during hard times. In October alone, some 79,000 jobs in New York City disappeared. This happened even as the steady current of funding that supports programs for the poor began to be diverted to the direct victims of the September 11th catastrophe. Private donations dropped at the same time that more people needed help. A recent Food for Survival study found that 64% of those visiting food banks this fall did so for the first time, many of them single mothers who recently lost jobs. But the problem is not now. The problem is 3 or 4 months from now. The bruises from the brunt of vanished work will show then. The evictions will go through. Unless the city delivers emergency rental assistance and protects the working class from losing its grip, the homeless population could explode. "We're not going to know the long-term impact until a few months out," says Patrick Markey, a senior policy analyst at the Coalition for the Homeless. That impact is going to be pretty severe. Homeless families are driven out by high housing costs and cutbacks in housing assistance. The Giuliani administration for 7 years has been slashing the budget for affordable housing, while market forces drove up rents. What's frustrating is that the general public is sympathetic now for people who have been affected, but will that last until the spring? That's tough. The Holy Apostle Soup Kitchen at 28th Street and 9th, the city's largest, saw an 11% spike in visitors after September 11th, continuing an increase that started in early summer. It was already a bad situation made worse by the economy and worse by September 11th, says program coordinator Clyde Carmelli, standing by the kitchen of the 19th-century Italianate church on a recent afternoon. Put all that together, and that's a pretty hard time for a lot of folks. Holy Apostles doesn't keep firm numbers, but something like 40% of the guests have a place to live, and a quarter work full-time jobs. At one table, a group of bike messengers, all rigged out in expanding fabrics and straps in that wind-riding bike messenger way, lament the state of their profession. September is commonly the month the business lifts back up after the summer drag. Instead, it sank. Tightened security slows them down on a job based on how fast you can go, and for weeks the air downtown made it hard to ride. Although they say business is improving, they're still making as little as $250 a week when they should be up to around $450. I've got a family to feed, says Raphael McElrath, 38, who lives on Coney Island and has his wife and four kids. Just before it happened, I was getting 18 to 20 jobs a day. On the 11th, I had one job the whole day. I stood around for four or five and went home. Now I'm averaging 10. Out front, Dave Parker says he's already noticed a change in the streets. 2 months ago, we noticed a large number of new people coming in, says Parker, 45. Now, speed up the tape. World Trade Center people were employed with a nice comfort zone. Now it's hard. A lot of people had a little bit of money in the bank. But if people miss one or two checks, guess what? They'll be homeless. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. I'm Robert Norris. In the studio with me is activist Chris Fredrickson. Camp Paradise is going to create its own home tomorrow. Want to be a part of that process? Give a call to 425-4787. Carl Wilson will be having a meeting at 4 o'clock this afternoon at 137 Felker Street. Friends of Camp Paradise are invited to attend. That could be you. If you want to be a part of this discussion, there's a number to call. It's 427-3772. 427-3772. And I ran across a good story this morning that kind of perked me up, and I thought I would run it by you, actually. And Chris, who wants to have a word or two. Why don't we let her in first before I babble on? Go ahead, Chris.
Thanks, Robert. It occurs to me that I would like to have a final word while I'm still have a chance to be in the air. This is a very serious undertaking, this building of Paradise 2 that we're going to be doing in the next 24 hours. And I would like very much to put a plea out to anyone who's listening. We would not have been able to sustain Camp Paradise this summer without all the outside help and support and the media attention that we got. And we're very vulnerable. In the next 24 hours, we're going to be announcing the site at this 4 o'clock meeting, and from then on it's going to be public knowledge, which of course means it's going to be police knowledge. If any of you, whether you can haul things or can simply be there, any help that we can get, human presence is going to be very important. We're going to need people to help haul. We're also going to need people at the new site. We have some disabled people in the Paradise community that would be unable to protect themselves should the police decide to come visit us right away before we're even at full strength. We're going to need media people, which, I mean, we will be contacting them. But you, as just a simple being, are very, very valuable to us. If you can come out tomorrow morning when we will be actually setting up camp, that would be of great value to us. We haven't been able to do any of what Camp Paradise has been able to accomplish without simple human presence. And, just community support has gone a great deal to having the camp do what it's been able to do. And I also want to mention there's been some flack towards the camp because we have been getting what's been called preferential treatment. My answer to that is always that Although the camp has been my home, and I have received a great many gifts from being part of the Paradise family, my first and foremost reason for continuing this work is our homeless rights in general. And I believe that this is a pilot project that is going further and deeper than any other projects that have gone in the past. Although I wasn't there, I've heard a lot and delved a lot into the history of homeless rights movements in Santa Cruz, and I feel that each time one of these rises up and there's a kind of a rift in the history and something like Camp Paradise has been able to break through, we need to take it as far as we can. And we need to continue with Paradise living. Paradise needs to live, and Paradise 2 is going up. We need all the help we can get. If you can even just show up and sit with us for a few hours tomorrow morning, we have people that need to be protected. Paradise 2 is a very young baby right now, and we need all the help we can get. Thank you for everything that any of you have done by just coming down to camp this summer, because every little bit of human energy has been needed to come this far, and now we need to go further. We're taking steps into the unknown, and please come be part of that. We're having a meeting at Carl Wilson's, as Robert said, this afternoon. We'll know the site for sure by then. You can also reach me at 462-3419, and hopefully Robert will have a message on the Huff line by this evening as to where the site is. If you don't catch up with this or cannot haul equipment, that's perfectly fine if you can just come out to the site tomorrow. Your presence and your energy will be very valuable to us. Thank you.
Bring some warm clothing, too, for these for yourself.
Yes.
I'm wandering around in a short-sleeve shirt and freezing my butt off out there. Yeah. Well, eloquently put, Chris. Eloquently put. And, I mean, the situation speaks for itself, but you speak well for the situation. That's Chris Fredrickson here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. This is Bathrobe Spears Broadsides at 96.3 FM. Our call-in number is 427-3772. Join us on the air. I'm going to read now a little something that really encouraged me this morning. Something that happened in August in Montreal. I'm going to read. This is about a successful homeless activity. Montreal, August 2nd. It was an eventful day for the squatters who've occupied an abandoned downtown building since last Friday. Another large city-owned building offered by the mayor's office was accepted by the squatters under their own conditions, which included an amnesty from criminal charges, the assumption of all costs by the city, as well as collective self-management. Meanwhile, six squatters who barricaded themselves inside the original Overdale building were evicted at night in a major police operation involving three busloads of police and the riot squad. And the headlines for this story are: historic victory for squatters. Amidst police intervention, squatters obtained new building to be collectively self-managed. Six remaining squatters at original building evicted in major police operation, while five supporters arrested. It was an eventful day for the squatters who've occupied an abandoned downtown building since last Friday. The day started with a pre-planned 10 a.m. meeting between city reps and squat delegates at the Hotel de Ville, City Hall. The squatters originally saw the meeting as simply an attempt to buy time for the squat while preparing for the next step in its defense. Instead, Mayor Pierre Bourquet's office decided to offer the squatters another building if they vacated the Overdale site in the afternoon. The squatters, including street youth, anti-poverty and social housing activists, anarchists, and other individuals, were wary of any attempt to be co-opted into accepting government-run co-op housing or a similar public relations maneuver. The mayor made such a proposal on Monday, and it was soundly rejected. However, the new proposal met all key particulars of the squatters' struggle, including a rent-free space allowed to be collectively self-managed by squatters, as well as the new building, a large former youth rehabilitation center, had much more possibilities as a space. The squatters met in General Assembly inside the first floor of the squat to discuss the proposal for the most of the afternoon, while others visited the building offered by the city. During the assembly, the squatters made an additional demand for an unconditional amnesty from any potential charges relating to the squat. That demand, which was key to eventual approval in assembly, was communicated by phone and also accepted by the mayor's office and his main negotiator, City Councilor Claire St. Arnaud. We're talking again about Montreal, Quebec, and we're talking about August of this year. The debate in assembly continued, and with the amnesty issue resolved, 61 to 14 voted in favor of moving to the new location and vacating Overdale. Those arguing in favor of the proposal underlined what some called the historic nature of what was happening. A group of poor and marginalized people had, through a direct action, managed to secure a rent-free space to be self-managed by participants. An important precedent for squatting was being established in Montreal, Quebec, and Canada, if not the rest of North America. Moreover, the squatters were dealing with the city from a position of power, mainly due to their willingness to resist and the public's sympathy for their actions. Many also felt that squatting actions would start to flourish in Montreal with the example of Overdale, and that squatting had gained legitimacy. For those in opposition, there was a discomfort with any dealings with the city. One person called the offer a potential poison candy. As well, many felt an attachment to the original building that had developed into a community since Friday. There was also a certain feeling of hypocrisy leaving a site that they had vowed to defend, no matter the offer of a new rent-free building. In the end, the overwhelming majority of squatters began moving their belongings out of the squat and into the trucks the city had provided. There were also three red buses to transport the squatters. While people began moving at around 5 p.m., a group of between 12 to 15 squatters began preparing to stay and organized to barricade themselves inside. Many supporters stayed on site in anticipation of the police intervention as well as to offer solidarity. By about 8 p.m., a few hours after a bulk of squatters had departed for the new location, the Montreal police arrived in force. There were three public transit buses full of police as well as several other police vans with the riot squad. In a press scrum, not sure what that would be, André Durocher, the media spokesperson for the Montreal police, began to create fear against the remaining squatters, referring to their occupation of, quote, private property. He stated that the remaining squat residents were a hardcore group of people who wanted a confrontation. Mathieu, a squat delegate who stayed behind in solidarity with the remaining squatters, interrupted the scrum. He stated that while he might have decided to leave, it was ludicrous that squatters were being treated as criminals for occupying a building that had been abandoned for over 13 years. Soon, a delegation of four senior police officers approached the squat, and one commandant demanded that everyone vacate the building and surrounding parking lot immediately. He also asked in French, "Is there a leader here?" His speech was heckled, and some supporters were dancing throughout. Eventually, the police moved in and created a large perimeter around the squat, south on Overdale to René Lévesque on the north, and Lucien Lallier on the east to Mackay on the west. A dispersed crowd of about 100 still remained outside the police cordon on René Lévesque, chanting "Solidarity" in French, while some heckled the cops. A contingent of riot police, with little warning, charged into the crowd, banging their shields and indiscriminately hitting with batons anyone that did not move fast enough. The baton charge moved right up Bishop Street to St. Catherine. One arrest was made at this time. Meanwhile, the police continued to forcibly move back supporters, effectively keeping witnesses away from good side of the squat building. Another baton charge was made up Mackay Street. The police were seemingly trying to provoke a riot, and in anger, at least one police car was smashed. As it so happens, it was the media relations car. Eventually, the entire perimeter was cordoned off, but supporters were able to regain a sight line near the youth hostel on Mackay. Others were able to secure access to an apartment rooftop, which provided a clear view of the police operation. There were close to 100 police surrounding the lot and at least three dozen riot police on hand, including a special tactics team. Sometime after 9 p.m., a police commandant, this time with a megaphone, asked that the remaining squatters vacate the building. During other interventions, the commandant mentioned the potential charges that the squatters would face. Occasionally, the squatters barricaded the second door inside. Occasionally, the squatters barricaded on the second floor inside replied, but their words were barely audible. It was always unclear how many were inside. During the standoff, four more arrests were made of supporters on the outside. Police grabbed one young man known as the Clown because of his ever-present clown nose. Shortly afterwards, three street medics, two men and a woman, were grabbed from a distance and put into a police van. Both arrests were seemingly arbitrary and at a distance from the squat, and it's unclear what the exact charges will be. In total, there were five arrests at the scene, although some mainstream media report referred to six. At about 9:30 p.m., the commandant mentioned that the remaining squatters would be allowed to go without charges if they left immediately. At this point, there was movement inside, and eventually, after waving a squatter's flag, a red flag with the international squatting symbol, six people slowly climbed down from the second floor. They raised their fists while the supporters on rooftops and on the street clapped and again chanted solidarity. The six remaining squatters walked toward the Lucien Lallier metro station, watched and filmed by the police. By all reports, they were not arrested, and some of them traveled to the new building. One person who was part of the last six later mentioned that the last squatters felt they had made their point, while others were having second doubts about waiting for the police to arrest them or worse. The last group had included two minors. The new building obtained by the squatters straddles the Rosemont and Holichaga Maisonneuve neighborhoods of Montreal in the east side. It's located at 3100 Rachel Street East at the corner of Préfontaine, minutes from the Préfontaine Metro on the Green Line. The building, known formerly as the Centre de Acul Rachel, is a former youth rehabilitation center. It's three stories, four in one section, and about five times the size of the Overdale squat. There are several balconies and outdoor stairwells, many large and small rooms, closets, washrooms, showers, as well as a kitchen and freezer room. The building is surrounded by a grass lot, trees, and beside a community garden. Unlike the downtown Overdale squat, which was close to the high-rise hotels and shops, the new squat is in a mixed residential industrial area with apartment blocks nearby, as well as a Loblaws superstore across the street in an industrial lot. The mayor's willingness to cede the building is undoubtedly related to the upcoming city election in early November. There has been much public sympathy for the squatters, and the mayor was clearly avoiding any major public confrontation between police and squatters. As well, the mayor was also involved in damage control for his remarks on Monday that there wasn't really a homeless problem in Montreal. Election or not, the squatters and activists who were lounging at the new site late on Wednesday night were euphoric, if dead tired. Their site is rent and tax-free, with heating and electrical costs incurred by the city. Crucially, the building is to be self-managed by the squatters themselves with no city intervention. The building is theirs indefinitely, although the mayor has indicated through the media that he hopes in about 2 years an official city-approved cooperative will be set up. Other cynical commentators expect that the mayor and city's mood to change after the November election. Whatever the case, minimally, the squatters have a new building with enormous possibilities for the foreseeable short-term future, if not longer. Looking at the building and the surrounding area, squatters were talking about creating office spaces for radical activist groups, a kitchen for Food Not Bombs, a garden project, library, free school, meeting spaces, media room, and, of course, accessible social housing. Transforming the new building, which is yet to be named, will be a huge challenge. But talking to the squatters on the scene yesterday, they're ready to get to work. An assembly is scheduled for tomorrow morning, that was 4 months ago, as well as a block party on Friday night to introduce themselves to their new neighbors. Already there are small signs that the transformation has begun. The old sign leading to the building has been replaced with a large, simple banner, a black and white fist raised in resistance. And that's written and reported by Jagi Singh for Indie Media Montreal. And that's at http://squat.net or montreal.indiemedia.org or www.ainfos.ca. And if you want further information on this story, give a call to 423-HUFF, 423-4833, and I will repeat for you any of those numbers and addresses. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM here in Santa Cruz. And we got about half an hour to go, so if you want to get with the show, give us a call at 427-3772.
Thirteen cholos at my door, the same 13 the day before, hanging out looking real chingon. If you squint your eyes, they all kind of look alike. Bald-headed, no-shirt-wearing, saggy-baggy khakis on the front porch. When I'm detached like this, I can almost see how they must look to the pigs that drive by every hour. 3 a.m., Tres Flores, slick back streets of San Juan after a good rain, always lead me home, and there they are, same as I left them. Empty bottles of 40-ounce malt liquor on the steps, the smell of mota lingers in the air. Everybody's fucked up, including me. And at these times, I think like they could see beyond the tie and briefcase I come home in every day, like I could see beyond the tattooed tear on their cheek, and we could really get to know each other, you know, hang out as one raza, Latinos, Unidos, and all that good shit. But a simple, hey, what's up, is as far as it'll go tonight. As I get to the front door, I pass a fine-looking cholita under the yellow streetlight. Her purple lipstick looks just right. She couldn't be more than 16 or 17. Sometimes she holds a bottle of Thunderbird. Sometimes she holds a baby. And sometimes when I'm fucked up like this, I can't tell which is which. But I don't look too long, because she's Victor's hyena. And he's the most chingonest of them all. I stumble upstairs and pass out to the sounds of Angel Baby playing on downstairs as the cholo slips softly into the darkness of the night. 13 cholos.
And we have about 20 minutes left here on Free Radio Santa Cruz with Bathrop Spears Broadside. So let's go back to Tuesday's City Council and pick up on a few conversations that I was able to record at that time. Also, be aware that there is a meeting at 4 o'clock today if you want to help save Camp Paradise, or should I say build Camp Paradise 2. That's what's going to be happening. We're going to be announcing a site, and we're going to be preparing to do that by tomorrow at 11 o'clock in the morning when folks are ousted from the Seabreeze Motel and the new paradise will be rising. So be a part of that process. Come on down. For more information, you can give a call to 423-HUFF or to Carl Wilson at 425-4787. 425-4787. A couple of other brief notes. I believe we have a tomorrow, Monday evening at 7 p.m., the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom is going to be meeting with special guest Paul Brindell of the Community Action Board and Elizabeth Vogel of Mercy Housing on the second floor of the Santa Cruz Public Library. Now, you may not know this. Brindell, though good man on the camping ban, is horrible on the Dolphin Lee Project, and that's, of course, what Elizabeth Vogel is primarily associated with. She's Mercy Charities Housing's PR woman and development expert and the person who has been ramming this stuff through City Council along with the rest of her Mercy Housing folks. And there'll be a chance to confront those people and ask them some solid questions, although, frankly, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom bought the Vogel line on the Mercy Charities Housing Dolphin Lee Project years ago, and they have not given it any kind of rational analysis ever since, so it's not likely to happen. But if you want to be a part of that, that's 7 o'clock tomorrow, free, second floor of the library, Monday night, and it's CAB and Mercy Housing has a love fest with the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. At 8:30 on Thursday morning, I should say 8:30 on Wednesday morning, you have the HUFF meeting. That's Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom down in Baker Square. That's a cafe on Ocean Street right across from Beach City Gas. Come on down with all the HUFFsters, although a lot of us HUFFsters are going to be huffing around Paradise too and probably parking our tents down there as well to be a solidarity with the Paradise 2 as it goes up and as it tries to remain, as the only affordable housing for dozens of people in Santa Cruz. Then on Thursday at 8:30, if you want, come to the small claims court case of Mary Curry. That's a 76-year-old woman, or 75, one of the two, who has been out there on the streets for, almost 2 years now, is it? She's going to be suing a police officer for abusive behavior when she was removed from the Homeless Services Center Armory Winter Shelter last winter in a trespass action initiated by Armory staff or by ISSP staff there. And she claims to have had injuries, and she'll be taking the police to court. That's 8:30 a.m. Department 1, Thursday. That's today is the 16th, so it would be 17, 18, 19, 20th. It'll be on the 20th of December. All these things coming up, coming at you. Now this, we'll go back to City Council and hear some talk after City Council's closing down of oral communications without allowing homeless speakers or the rest of the community, for that matter, to have the time it was asking for.
Mr. Macron did not allow any of the, most of the 23 speakers to speak. He declined to extend oral communications time at all. He told people to lower signs, even though no one had complained in the back of the area that the signs were up. Hey!
Hi, how's it going?
Where's my hug? Oh, I'm taking her to here. She's mine.
How's that going?
Oh, it's usual.
The usual.
We have a little affordable housing development now going up. Tent is rising. I don't. Yeah, I've got a photo ID to get into this. I'm sorry. We get a fingerprint, people.
We got it.
All right. Well, that's good.
Now
we have the tent. But do we have the tenacity? Is the question.
Out here tonight.
Just glad we have.
This is the satellite shelter program. It will accommodate 1,000 people.
Camp Paradise.
It's in the Santa Cruz tradition. Another thing Crone did.
Which way do we want the border face?
I don't know. Your suggestion is as good as mine. I mean, I don't know.
We're talking to Bam Bam Jr.
And BBJ, you're an illegal camper.
Well,
depends on who's going to hear this. Police department, city council, your mother.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
And are you camped in the city or outside the city?
Well, I'm in the city.
Would you like to give us the exact coordinates and the color of your tent, please?
I plead the fifth.
All right. So how many people are in your camp?
Just me and my dog.
And your dog. So why don't you use the Armory Interface Satellite Shelter Program?
Because I like to be out in nature, and I don't like being woken up at 5 o'clock in the morning to leave. And I like to have my own space, basically.
There you have it. A renegade anarchist whose only concern seems to be spreading riot and discontent throughout our community. Aren't you ashamed?
Absolutely.
Thank you. We're talking to...
If I were to go to jail or whatever, who would be taking care of my daughter?
Your name is?
Lois.
Lois, you're here with a sign that says, we need more housing now, vote yes on Schaefer Road Project. How many of you are there here tonight?
Like now? I don't know. What does it look like? A couple of hundred?
There's probably about 100 people in the whole area.
You ask me, I'm telling you.
But I mean, among your group, how many?
Among my group. Everybody you see of color is among my group.
But we should mention you are an African-American woman.
No, I said of color.
Of color. What about me? Am I very... What do you think?
That's your thing.
Gray doesn't count. This ageist dog, you're going to get it. So, what are you folks pushing for tonight?
Affordable housing. Like I said, I said earlier, I was born and raised here in Santa Cruz. I grew up on the west side of Santa Cruz, and the way it is now, I can't afford to live here anymore. You know? I can't. Why shouldn't I live here? I was born and raised here. My parents paid taxes until they died. I work and pay taxes until, who knows, until whatever. I have no intention of leaving the county.
What is this affordable housing project that you are supporting? Want to give us some details?
Over on Schaefer Road, I think they want to put up like about 230 units over there, and they want to make it affordable.
Well, does affordable means like $60,000 a year or less,
no,
right?
Because that's not affordable, because that would bump me out right there.
Well, that's
$40,000 would bump me out. Affordable here, I mean, you know, here, yeah.
Watch out, because that's what affordable technically means. So be careful.
Well, no, I'm careful about
it. Low income, and there's very low income, and there's affordable. Affordable is $60,000 or less.
Okay, I can't afford low income because I have bad credit anyway,
right,
so I can't even get in there. And then when
how many of these would be low income or very low?
Supposedly all of them, and I believe it because George Al is behind this particular project.
We're talking about George Kick Out the Low Income Auto Lot Al. That's the George Al.
No, I don't think so. There's too many things I've seen George do.
Well, I saw him do that. Maybe he's done some other things. He's one of the big developers in town. I know that.
Yes, he is. But he also put jobs on the west side of Santa Cruz when he built Long's over there. So, I mean, come on. He also continued to make sure there were jobs on over 41st Road when they rebuilt the cinemas over there. He could have just let that stuff go down, but he didn't.
Well, you're always going to have jobs that's being built.
And then there's also George, who pushes for young students. He gives them a chance. He helps them.
You like this guy, don't you?
Yes, I do, because I've seen...
Is there some relationship here that I should know?
No, there's no relationship.
I'm just keeping an eye out here. I'm keeping a very close eye.
No, my sister introduced me to him, so I know him that way.
Let's get a Craig. Hey, Becky Johnson. Ho! Johnson. Too late. Oh, well. So, but we've been talking with
Lois.
And Lois, is there actually going to be a vote tonight on this project, up or down?
I have. I don't think they're going to vote tonight on the project because they've got too much stuff going.
And what
we'll have to just come back down here again.
And what are the issues? The issues is that neighbors are objecting, or is it money?
No, to me the issue is kind of silly. They wanted them to pull it back from the wetlands, which, okay, I can deal with that because if I'm living there and it's raining, I really don't want it coming up to my door. But also the asinine one I figured was when they said they don't want it visible from Antonelli's Pond, and the fish don't even live in Antonelli's Pond anymore. You know what I'm saying?
What about the fish's eye view of the whole? What about the ghost of the fishes?
Who cares about the ghost? They ain't costing nothing. I need to live.
There you have it. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So, Becky Johnson, you're a video journalist. You, what did you think of the Camp Paradise situation? And I guess two or three people talked from Camp Paradise, and I was wondering how low they would go in licking the toes of the city council. What do you think?
Well, it was kind of one of those times where all they could think of was to thank the council members, I guess because for the two-week vouchers that they got in area motels, which is above and beyond what the police usually do when they roust a camp or have a group of homeless people. But usually the city doesn't come up with any kind of motel voucher, so I suppose that was what it was about. But I think it was kind of short-sighted on the part of the Camp Paradise people, because their vouchers run out Sunday, and this is the same council that has not come up with a site for them to move to. And I wish that they had spent their time addressing the council and asking them where they were supposed to move to once the vouchers run out, rather than thank them for their lodging this evening.
Yavol. And, of course, Christopher Crone did his usual number of not expanding any oral communication, even though he's mayor and could presumably actually take some initiative in that matter. I noticed 23 people wanted to speak, and some people...
I didn't understand why he bothered to count and then just announced he was going to do 30 minutes oral communication. They have to do a 30 minutes oral communication by law. What does it matter if there are 23 people or 12 people that want to, if that's the decision, why count?
Also, it was interesting, several people over the other side of the room started using mics that are not normally used, cutting back on the oral communication of people in line. And he also seemed to be object when I went up to move my mic over to deal with a disabled woman.
Yeah, he said, stop moving around, which I found rather amusing. It's a new one from a mayor at Santa Cruz.
Criminal motion.
Moving around at city council chambers. I have previously seen many people moving around, and I've never even heard Mayor Fitzmaurice complain about moving around.
It seemed like the Fitzmaurice regime has essentially dictated the rules that he's now going to follow. He's adopted wholesale the rules that Fitzmaurice was using.
Well, I have noticed that Chris Crone has already told people he would meet them with if Robert Morse wasn't there, and he's doing that kind of exclusionary policy. This is the same mayor who promised to open up city council and make it more accessible and more welcome to people, and presumably that he's going to listen to all members of the public, but I guess not you, Robert.
I think it's actually
yeah.
Important to
thank
the council.
I told him the hat doesn't look right.
This is Sarah Phelan of the Metro. Sarah, what kind of a fashion statement does that hat make in your view?
I don't know. You look like a retired bowler.
There you are. Activist and Button Street resident Ed Davidson, how are you doing? Looking a little tired, eh?
Yes, I am.
Now, what's this Schaefer housing deal? And give us kind of a summation of what's going on here.
Well, I'm supporting it, and I have some reservations about some of the conditions they want to put on it. But
what exactly is it? I mean, sum it up for us.
It is a rental housing project, which is critically needed. It is designed in a way that 40% of the units will be what are called affordable.
Which means 60% of median income or something like that?
60% would be market rate.
Right.
And
60% of median income is...
What the median income here is
60,000 something.
Yeah, something like that. But
you have to make it legal.
If you
make 60,000 or less, you'll be accessible. You'll be available to you.
Right, but they have a different formula. Actually, they're going to be, half of them are making 50% of median income. And the median income, some of these are smaller apartments, and your median income is defined for a family of four, for individuals. They're different.
Not for low or very low income people, right?
There will be low income, yes, I would call it low income.
Wouldn't people in the higher brackets going to grab up all the space?
Well, they've decided by formula that 50% of the income will go for half of those. That's considered very low income. 50% of median. But the median is not necessarily for a family of four. It could be for an individual.
So how many... Is this going to take any homeless people off the streets or not?
No.
But it will provide rental housing. For how many units? How many people?
The two projects together, I forget that, they're 300 or something units. So 40% of 300 is 120 units. And 120 units is better than no units.
What are the opponents saying about this?
I think we have a little bit of NIMBYism about traffic impacts and basically. But there is a complication here where they want to give priority to the people working in the University's Terrace Point, instead of putting enough housing on the Terrace Point area for the people working there.
So it's another university housing gobble?
Well, the beneficiaries should be the people who work in the middle of Santa Cruz and not the people who are working for the university.
Right, so again, it's university grabbing the housing.
That's probably going to be the case.
Well, UCSC Uber Alles, right?
Well, that was a question that came up, and we don't know what the answer is at this point.
Well, what kind of changes could be made to assure that doesn't happen if this council had the will?
Well, if we're dealing with families, there's a 7-year waiting list from the housing authorities list for family subsidized housing. This project, the Dolphin Lee and the Pacifics, all have no one coming off of that 7-year list to fill these units that get created with public city funds.
So they could give priority to the people on the list?
They're not giving any priority to the people.
But they could.
They could, yes.
They're choosing not to.
Correct.
Oh, wait a minute. This is our liberal, progressive city council concerned with low-income people?
Absolutely.
But not that concerned.
They are using this for political cover because they really haven't done anything in their terms on the council to actually expand the supply of housing. The first project that's come along, and this is the private sector doing it with some city help.
What kind of city help?
They're reinvesting the tax increments that would otherwise go into the redevelopment funds into this one project, into itself, in order to be able to make some 40% as inclusionary.
How much is that? Millions, billions, thousands?
Well, it's in the long term it would be millions, but the point is that the law requires that 15% of units be inclusionary affordable, and here we're getting 40% of the units inclusion affordable. That's a big difference. And to do that, they forego taking the tax increments from the project.
Well, thank you, Ed Davidson. Brian, you're a homeless. Okay, we're on the air now with caller Thomas Levitt. Hi, Thomas. You have been listening to the Schaefer discussion. Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to point out, anybody wants to find the exact specifics about this, just needs to go and look at the agenda and the council minutes for the last meeting. My recollection of the development is that there would be 206 units. Of those units, 83, or about 40%, would be reserved for, you know, moderate and low income. That's defined as, you know, people who can afford to spend $600 to $800 a month for an apartment who meet, you know, income qualifications. And, you know, that's really nice, but 80 units is only a small step and towards addressing the huge lack of housing that the city has.
How many units are needed in your mind?
Well, let's see. There's 2,000 homeless people in this area, and my guess is there's another 2,000 or 3,000 people beyond that that are living in converted chicken coops and crashing on people's couches and living in garages. So, you know, there's thousands.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the city's development policies have basically made it impossible for them, for housing to be built. And it was amazing to me that so many people showed up for this one opportunity to get this one unit built, which, you know, whatever George Al's record is, I mean, it's still going to make him money. I mean, he wouldn't be doing this if it's not going to make him money.
Mm-hmm.
And so you got to wonder where people are when, you know, Camp Paradise is about to be flooded out, or when all the other progressive issues, you know, are on the agenda. I mean, people turn, and, you know, to a certain extent, the reason people turn out here is because George Al has the resources to, you know, get in contact with people and, you know, make them aware of this. And it's clear, you know, some of these people didn't really have the full story on what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully we'll be able to put out some of the story when you and I show up today at 4 at Carl Wilson's house for the Paradise 2 preparations. That's at 137 Felker Street today. And for information, give a call to 425-4787. Much appreciate your calling in, Thomas. Any concluding remarks?
Show up at 4 o'clock and
for Bathrob Spears Broadsides, another fine show here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Next is going to be the infamous Vinny and whatever tidbits he has to toss our way, like bits of raw beef. Of course, I'd prefer to continue for another hour and a half, but do I get a chance? No way. Instead,
don't you have another show on Thursday?
Mr. 73 hours a week, V-Man, is here with his show.
Actually, Robert, to clarify the issue here, I have a 2-hour and 15-minute program on Wednesday evening, and it's only 2 hours and 15 minutes because the guy that shows
up... He lives and breathes Free Radio.
Usually
this
late.
Man has got mainlines
and then
Free Radio,
I do my other
24
show...
24 hours a day.
My other show, the Weekly Freak Show, which isn't actually even my show completely. It's a compilation of all the different interviews and stuff that we do here at Free Radio, which you should contribute to once in a while, Robert. It would be nice.
Hey, why not?
Because I know you do a lot of interviews on your programs.
I'd be happy to give you my access to my tapes.
So, you know, whenever you got something... I'll take it and edit it down and totally distort your words.
Exactly, as you usually do. And I appreciate that kind of work on your part, Vinny. Actually, the V-Man here has been coming through with some great work. Is doing a regular show. I guess you're putting the Democracy Now! Folks on the air every Monday from 1 to 3 and Tuesday through Friday 12 to 2.
That's right. Actually, Skidmark's pretty much the person responsible for
well,
that.
The two of you have formed this unholy alliance.
Wow. You know, this sucks. We can't get online in here for some reason.
Well, there you are. It could be time for another hour of Bathrob Spears Broadside.
No, sorry.
We have a full
program planned at 2 p.m. that... we got coming up here in a little while.
I'm gonna have to leave you.
I think it's
a
good time for a musical break, possibly, especially now that the phone. Oh, let's take this last call.
This might be
Skidmark.
Hello there, you're on Free Radio.
Let me get the headphones.
Not Skidmark.
It's not Skidmark. Oh, it's Eon, isn't it?
Yeah. I just wanted to point out that Robert should provide a tape for me too for the digital archives.
I'd love to do that, Ian.
It's Eon.
Eon.
Yeah.
Well, eons of Ian. Fair enough. Well, why don't we talk about this off-air, and I will try to meet your requirements.
Okay, sounds good.
All righty, man.
Thank you for the call. That was very good. Robert, if you wouldn't mind podding up CD number 3 there and hitting the play button.
Fine. I'm censoring myself. These are sad days. All right, see you then, and thank you for being with us on Bathrob Spears Broadsides back on Thursday, 6 o'clock. Join us then, and come on down to Camp Paradise today at 4 o'clock with Carl Wilson.